You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
2,000 years ago, ancient Petra was the wealthy capital of a powerful Middle Eastern trading empire. In the 19th century, its ruins became a destination for wealthy tourists, but much of Petra's history has remained a mystery. Now archaeologists are piecing together a more complete picture of what Petra was like in its heyday, and with me now are Andrew Lawler, who wrote an article for the June issue of Smithsonian Magazine called Reconstructing Petra, and Christopher Tuttle, a Brown University graduate student in archaeology who works on the site, and he joins us now from Amman, Jordan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Christopher, for listeners who haven't seen photos of Petra or had the good fortune of visiting there, can you describe what the site looks like now?
Well, it's pretty much a desert landscape that's covered with a lot of rubble still in most places. We've only excavated pretty much less than 2% of the downtown area of the city.
But then there are those other buildings that are carved out of live rock.
Yes, those are mostly facades for tombs and other sort of communal ritual activity areas.
So is that why for a long time people thought that Petra was a city of tombs?
Pretty much, yes. When the early explorers started rediscovered the city in 1800s, it looked like a necropolis because there was only one freestanding building in the city center that was still visible.
How do you get to
Otherwise,
Petra?
It was just tomb facades.
How do you get there? Do you just take a camel from Amman?
No, actually Jeep Cherokee these days. it's become a very well-developed tourist site. So there's modern facilities and roads leading right into the town outside of the ancient site. And you pay your ticket and you enter the site.
Andrew, was it called Petra 2,000 years ago?
Well, that's a good question. The word Petra is Greek for rock. And clearly the city was named after the primary building material that they use, which was the stone that is very soft, which can be carved, and that's why they were able to carve these massive structures within the walls, some being tombs, some perhaps, as Chris noted, being places where people would go for communal gatherings. And it's a very comfortable place and to be in a cave like that in a climate where in the summer it's very, very hot, and the winter it can be very chilly, so it's actually very environmentally sensible to live that way.
Did they speak Greek?
Again, a good question. We know that the Nabataeans, who were the people who were living in Petra at the time, were influenced by the Greeks very strongly, and surely there were people speaking Greek because that was the language used by traders all over that part of the world in that era. But they had their own language, Nabataean, and they even left inscriptions in Nabataean, although we really aren't able to decipher what those inscriptions say.
Although their writing system forms the basis for written Arabic, doesn't it?
That's true. There's clearly a connection between Nabataean and later Arabic, but again, it's very hard to know exactly what they were saying. Most of these inscriptions are probably saying that, you know, George built this tomb, or you know, this is the house of Ahmad. We really don't know.
Yeah. Andrew, it's nice to hear your voice. How are you?
Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
What Andrew's saying is pretty much correct. We can decipher much of their language to this day, but these inscriptions that we have are very formulaic. I, so-and-so, son of such-and-such, made this. May the goddess bless me. That sort of thing.
And what do we know about the trade? This was the capital of a trading empire. What kinds of goods came through Petra?
Well, you name it. They were bringing in goods from the Arabian Peninsula to the south, particularly incense. Incense was the oil of its day. It was a very, very valuable commodity that everybody in the Near East wanted for their religious rituals, for use in food and medicine preparation. That would probably be the number one material that was coming through Petra. And they received enormous amounts of money for it because this material went for a lot of money in the marketplaces of Rome.
And the Mediterranean altogether. One of the other great trading items they had was black pepper, which they brought in via India, which was the only source at the time. And it was the most expensive commodity known in Rome and the ancient Mediterranean at the time. They also made quite a bit of money mining bitumen out of the Dead Sea.
Do we know anything about their religion?
Well,
the religion's quite enigmatic. We actually know that they had a primary god. We don't know the name of the god. We know a title for the god, Dushara, which means the Lord of the Shara Mountains, which tells us a little bit about what the god probably was, a vegetation god, a mountain god, perhaps a sky god in some capacity. And they had a main goddess that, again, we don't have a name. She's simply referred to by the name Alat, which means the goddess, and at Petra by Al-Uzza, which we don't know really what that means, but it seems to be referring to the same goddess. They had a handful of other lesser gods, one who oversaw trade and the protection of the caravans, one which may have had a military aspect, but by and large we have no real understanding of their theology.
Even though we know a lot about the religions of the people who lived in the Middle East at the time.
Yes, quite a bit. But in the case of the Nabataeans, as Andrew was saying, we don't really have much in the way of their own words. They didn't leave us any written documents of their own. All we know in terms of written sources were from external sources, Greek writers, Roman writers, the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus writing in Greek. But they didn't tell us anything about what they believed. So we have only bits and pieces that we can try to piece together based on what other people at the time said about them.
We do know that later there were Christians, of course, living there, and in fact there were there was a church built right across from the Great Temple where Chris has been working that dates to a later time, though, 6th, 7th century A.D.
Isn't it rumored that the biblical Aaron, Moses' brother, was buried nearby?
Well, Jebel Harun is a mountain that's not far away from Petra, and the tradition, which can't be backed up by strong archaeological evidence, but the tradition is that Aaron, who was the brother of Moses and the mouthpiece of the prophet, that he was buried on the top of that mountain, died on the top of the mountain, and there's a very old Christian building that was then later remodeled by Muslims, and also if you go inside of it, it actually has Hebrew verses as well. So it's an amazing ecumenical place, whether or not it is the actual site of Aaron's tomb or not.
Now, you said that they were written about by others. Greek historian Strabo wrote in the 1st century AD that foreigners in Petra are frequently engaged in litigation while the locals live together in perfect harmony. So it sounds to me like there were certain problems with the kind of trade that was carried on in the city.
Well, that passage is very much debated among scholars today, what exactly it means. It paints a fairly idealistic picture of the Nabataeans themselves. Most of the accounts given by Strabo actually are fairly positive, and so we really don't know what to make of that, other than to suggest that the courts were mostly active, involving the many different traders who were coming through from many different cities and regions around the Mediterranean at the time.
And the Romans also seemed to be looking down their noses a bit at the Nabataeans, who were excellent traders, but pretty lousy soldiers, according to some of the Roman historians.
Yeah, very much so.
My guests are Andrew Lawler, who wrote Reconstructing Petra for the June issue of Smithsonian Magazine, and we have a link to the article on our website. Christopher Tuttle, a Brown University graduate student in archaeology, who's working at the site. By the way, we also have photos of the Brown University excavation that Chris is working on. That they will be posted later this afternoon, a whole slideshow of beautiful photos of Petra that Chris has sent us, so listeners can just wait a few hours and get a real sense of what Petra is like. Now, when did archaeologists first start paying attention to the site, Chris?
Well, the first scientific missions to Petra, it was rediscovered by the West in 1812 approximately, and the first real scientific excavations, or more, they started out with surveys, documentation, were in the late 1800s. The first volume started to appear in German in 1904. And the first actual excavations didn't really begin until the late 1920s, early 1930s, first by British teams. The first Americans really came on the scene in the 1950s.
But it seems to have picked up only fairly recently. Is that because of changes in the political climate, or has the government of Jordan finally realized what a treasure they have?
probably all those are factors. A lot of it had to do in the difficulties, the logistics of the site up until the last couple of decades. It's really only been developed and opened safely to the public for just under 20 years. And prior to that, it was still a very remote region of Jordan. It took days. Now it takes 3 hours from Amman to drive there, but it could take days as recently as 20, 25 years ago.
Andrew, so, weren't there lush gardens and fountains? How is that possible? Has the climate changed so much?
Well, this is one of the fascinating things that archaeologists like Chris have uncovered in recent years. When you go there today, you see a very harsh landscape. It's very, very dry. It's like Utah with classical ruins. But in fact, Petra, in its heyday around the time of Christ, was a very lush place. And that was in part because the Nabataeans were very sophisticated when it came to their water systems. They built enormous cisterns, you know, giant holes in the ground that were made of rock, which would gather the water during the winter rains, and then they could use them during the hot, dry summers. And as a result, they were able to use their water quite lavishly, almost like they do in Las Vegas today. They were clearly gardens with trees. There was one area that next to the Great Temple where Chris is working, which may actually have been a public park of sorts that had a pavilion. It was a very green and wonderful place to live. There are lots of fountains. You don't get a sense of that at all today, but it's something to keep in mind if you ever go visit.
And you said that it lasted for quite a while. Christians even lived there. When did it finally go into serious decline?
Well, actually, the Christian part is actually quite interesting because some of our sources hint that the Nabataean city and the people who were living there at the time, who were probably still ethnically much the same as they had been under the Nabataeans, may have been one of the first areas to have converted to Christianity. There's some indications. We have very early Christian iconography inside Petra. It flourished well up until the time of the Islamic Revolution. After the Islamic Revolution, it really didn't have the political importance as in terms of its location and the fact that the early Islamic caliphates weren't as economically based on agriculture as the Byzantines had been. And they moved the capital around to other places, just to the south to Humayma, part of course the first caliphate in Damascus. It really starts to decline probably in the 8th century.
There's a lot that still remains to be excavated. Does anyone have any idea about what's hidden under all the layers of debris and sand?
Well, one thing that that Chris showed me when I was there last summer was an excavation done by another team at the top of a hill above the Great Temple, and it was a villa, very much a Roman-style villa with Pompeian-style paintings. You know, obviously there were very wealthy people living there in a very sophisticated Roman style. Of course, that was the style of the era. If you had money, you would build something that looked like something you would see in Italy of the day.
Do you think that today's Jordanians are descended from the Nabataeans?
That impossible to say. Peoples have moved around so much since those days, it's impossible to really say. And to my knowledge, no one's really done the mitochondrial DNA tracing to even begin. And we don't actually have that much in the way of physical remains that we can clearly say are Nabataean. That material is only recently coming to light because the tombs, the many tombs inside Petra, for the most part have been disturbed for centuries. People have been living in them and looting them. So we have very few undisturbed graves to get any sort of genetic markers that we could trace today.
And remember, this is an area that is peopled by Bedouin, who are nomadic people who move around with their sheep and goats. So there's been a lot of movement in that area over the past couple thousand years, particularly since Petra ceased to be a place that was producing a lot of its, or at least a good deal of its own food. Because at one time, as I mentioned, the water systems, they were able to grow, you know, quite a lot of the food that they were eating.
And where did they get that water from?
From the winter rain.
Mostly rainwater. One of the reasons Petra was chosen as a site is because it has some of the only permanent springs in the area. So they had permanent sources of water that came right into Petra or were inside Petra already. But the real key, and this is something Andrew was trying to really emphasize, is the Nabataeans were masters of ancient hydrology. They harnessed every drop of rain that fell on every surrounding mountain and channeled it to where they needed it. I mean, billions and billions and billions of cubic liters of storage have been discovered to date. and we've not even found them all.
And is there still water there?
Yeah, it is actually quite moist. As Andrew said, you don't see it when you get there today, but as an excavator, it's actually quite astounding. In July, when it's 115, 120 degrees, and the surface is parched, when you're excavating, you get actually 30, 40 centimeters down, and it's a relatively moist matrix because so much rain falls during the winter and gets below the surface, and it's actually a fairly moist environment.
We have to leave it there, but you can see pictures of Petra that Chris Tuttle has sent us later in the show. I mean, later in the day, also diagrams of Petra, and you can read Andrew Lawler's article that was in the June issue of Smithsonian Magazine by going to our website, wnyc.org. My great thanks to both of you, Andrew Lawler and Christopher Tuttle, for talking to us today about Petra. It seems to me that some of these mysteries will never be cleared up.
Well, that's part of the fun of archaeology, isn't it, Chris?
Absolutely, part of the fun. And we love the puzzle, and every little piece makes us very, very happy.